Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio here at 88.1 FM and also WDIY.org. I'm John Pierce, your host on this edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse, and I am honored to have as my guest this evening a gentleman who is a professor at Lafayette College. His name is Dr. John Kincaid, and listen to some of the topics that we are going to cover in the next hour. Because we're talking about political science and government, what is a federal form of government? How about legalized recreational marijuana? How about sanctuary cities? Arming teachers in schools? Partisan gerrymandering? And we have more for you. So Dr. John Kincaid is going to enlighten us on these topics and more this evening. You're in for a treat. Dr. Kincaid is an elected fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration and recipient of the Daniel J. Elazar Distinguished Scholar Award from the Section on Federalism and Intergovernmental Relations. Wow, that's a mouthful. Of the American Political Science Association and the Donald Stone Distinguished Scholar Award from the Section on Intergovernmental Administration and Management of the American Society of Public Administration. John Kincaid received his PhD in 1981 from Temple University. And John, that was in the, was it specifically government or political science?
Political science, yes.
Political science. And Dr. Kincaid has served as editor of Publius, the Journal of Federalism, senior editor of the Global Dialogue on Federalism, and editor of a series of books on the governments and politics of the American states. And we're going to talk a little bit about this during our hour also. In 1972 to 73, Dr. Kincaid was vice president of the Pentagon Papers Fund for the Defense of Human and Civil Liberties, the legal defense organization for Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo in the Pentagon Papers trial in Los Angeles. That seems like such a long time ago, John.
Yes, it does, though. We just had a movie about the Pentagon Papers come out now.
And he has lectured and consulted on issues of federalism, intergovernmental relations, state and local government, and decentralization throughout the United States, as well as in 26 foreign countries. John, you've actually counted that there are 26, I guess, huh, where you've been?
I guess so, if you counted them up.
you must keep an exhaustive list. So Dr. Kincaid has been all over the place. Before we go further, let me say that his wife, we have to give a shout-out to Lucille Kincaid, who is one of my colleagues here at WDIY. She does the WDIY Classics, and mostly on Tuesday mornings. And she is the one who pointed me in Dr. Kincaid's direction. She said, hey, this could be a really great Lehigh Valley discourse. So, John, let's get right to some of the issues that you are pointing toward in this interview. First of all, a very basic question, and I think it's a great one to remind us all. The United States has a federal form of government. What exactly does that mean? Aren't we just a democracy?
That means that power is divided between what we usually call the federal government in Washington, D.C., and the states. And it was the only way the country could feasibly be organized in 1787 when the Constitution was written. If you recall, we had an Articles of Confederation that preceded the Constitution. The Confederation government did not have the authority to tax or conscript people into the military or regulate commerce. And that was really began to be seen after the Revolutionary War as a weak form of government. So the innovation in the U.S. Constitution, which is the first time in human history, was to create a what's now called a federation, rather a confederation, but in a federal form of government. The federal government has the authority to tax us. As we know from just recently, we had our income taxes all due to the federal government, conscript into the military, regulate commerce. So The United States created the first federal system in the modern world, and it has since been a model for many other federal systems. So people have to bear in mind Canada is a federal system, partly modeled after the U.S. Mexico is a federal system, Germany, Switzerland, Belgium, India is a federal system. So it is a model that has grown to about 40% of the world's people today live in federal countries.
I never realized that the federal system was our invention here.
It was, yes, it was. And so it was original, and it was the really the only way to have a democracy in a large territory, which is another innovation. If you look at governments of large territories before the United States, you had empires, the Roman Empire, one empire after another. And federalism became so before the United States, democracy was pretty much confined to small republics, you know, beginning with ancient Athens, which we usually look back to as the origin of democracy. And so many people believed in 1787 you could not have a democracy over such a large territory as the original 13 states. So the federal system really made democracy viable for a large territory.
Now, speaking of the size of nations, Switzerland is a small country. And so very often, I think they have plebiscites in which all the citizens vote on certain measures that we would have decided by our Congress. I guess just because of the size of their country.
And it fits the Swiss tradition, the way their federal system evolved over a very long period of time, several centuries. They were a confederation really up to 1848, and then they looked at the U.S. Constitution and changed their constitution and became more of a federal system. But they retained the direct popular vote. But, you know, Switzerland has a population of around 8 million people, so it's smaller than New York City. And
smaller than Pennsylvania.
So they can do it. But when you look at size, seven of the eight territorially largest countries in the world are all federal. The only exception is China, which is non-federal. But Australia, Brazil, even Russia is constitutionally federal. It isn't really governed that way, but so it's a form of government suited to large territories or small countries like Switzerland, where you have different languages and different religions that need to be accommodated.
And so one way of saying it would be that the federal form of government, instead of running everything from the central government, it spreads out the responsibilities among states or provinces or whatnot.
Right. And so in the case of the United States, it was the states delegating power to the federal government. And those are a limited set of powers. And then as reiterated in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, all powers not given to the federal government are retained by the states. So from a technical legal point of view, for most of our history, the states had most of the power. The federal government today still has very limited powers.
And I would assume that comes way back in the 18th century when the immigrants to North America were suspect of great centralized power because they were coming from nations where the king decided everything and there was no separation of powers.
Right. So you had mostly centralized regimes in those days.
And to visitors to the United States today from such countries, it's sometimes very confusing to think, well, why, if to use a trivial example, a sign on the highway in Pennsylvania that says littering, $100 fine, move into Ohio, and it says littering, $200 fine. Why would you have this chaotic system of the states deciding all these things when these people from European countries, say, are used to one law for the whole country?
Right. And, well, all those European countries are very small. But you do. In Switzerland, you go from one canton to another, the signs change languages,
yeah,
as
true.
They do in Canada. If you've been to Quebec and you drive into Quebec from Ontario, the signs are suddenly French. So it really is a system that allows different communities of people to make their own decisions. So you have different cultures and ways of life. Even today in the United States, the states differ in culture to some degree, socioeconomic makeup, population makeup. And so you have different political preferences from one state to another. And so a federal system allows for the accommodation of those differences.
Right.
And you see that across the country.
All you have to do is just think about three of our great cities, Boston, New Orleans, and San Francisco, and think the difference in the
Absolutely.
Populations
yes,
in those
different.
Places.
Yes.
It's almost as if, how can we be one country? And the same thing I find in France as well, from Brittany down to the Marseille and the south of France and so on, very, very different populations. What are some of the actual impacts of federalism on people's lives?
Well, you see it in the different laws in different states that we were just mentioning briefly. You see it in the different preferences the states have. So, you know, what might take marijuana, for example, just one example. I mean, it's still a criminal offense in some states. In other states, it's not a criminal offense. So you have a tremendous variation that's going to have an impact on you. Licensing requirements, not just for automobiles, but for occupations, is done by the states, and that varies considerably among the states. And a license may not always be transferable. So if you're a barber in one state, your license might not be transferable if you move to a different state.
Just comes so, into play with physicians, dentists,
right.
lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, our system seems to be not as efficient as it would be if we had one licensing for the whole country.
Well, that's a question. I mean, a federal system is often actually very efficient. If you have a single licensing system for the country as a whole, you could have a lot of inefficiencies in a centralized bureaucratic arrangement. When you think of the size of the United States, you have to keep in mind 310 million people now across a very large territory. So we're huge compared to France or any of these other countries. And so the inefficiencies that get introduced by centralization, and I don't know, does anybody ever think of the federal government as being particularly efficient? And you know,
not that I recall.
So what does they say? Washington, D.C. is a city of northern charm and southern efficiency.
Well, and when you mentioned this huge federal bureaucracy to run a licensing, let's say, of some of these professions, it brings to my mind the vision of yet another huge building in Washington, D.C. that would have to be staffed by thousands of people.
Right.
That's what it would turn out to be.
Now, which is not to say the federal government can't influence these things. If you take driver's licenses, for example, the federal Real ID law requires all states to produce driver's licenses that conform to the security requirements now of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And the states have complained about that because that's an expensive proposition. But the Department of Homeland Security is becoming much tougher and is going to enforce these regulations by 2020. So Pennsylvania currently is non-compliant. So if the state doesn't produce driver's licenses that are compliant, you won't be able to use it to get on an airplane, for example, or open a bank account or enter a federal building.
And when did all that start?
Well, this started in 2005 as a result of the use of driver's licenses by the hijackers on 9/11. And so we use our driver's licenses regularly to board airplanes. So the federal government, you know, the Real ID law was passed by Congress simply to bring all states still produce their own licenses, but they have to comply with certain security requirements of Homeland Security.
So let's turn to this question. Many people cite the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis's famous 1932 opinion that states in our federal system serve as laboratories of democracy that can, quote, try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country, end quote. Do you find this to be true, and do we have some examples of that?
It has been true really since the beginning of the Republic. If you go back to the 19th century, even though the Constitution authorizes Congress to pass a bankruptcy law, it didn't do it until 1896. So you had most of the states adopted bankruptcy laws, and they served as models eventually for the federal legislation. If you look at the New Deal, most of the social welfare legislation that was produced by the New Deal under Franklin Delano Roosevelt had already been tried in the states, and that was part of what Justice Brandeis was responding to in that particular case, that we had a lot of these social welfare experiments going on. And then when you look to today, you see a lot of experimentation in healthcare. You could say legalization of marijuana is a form of experimentation, so we can look and see what are the consequences of legalizing marijuana in the states that have done it, and if other states want to legalize marijuana, what can we learn from the states that have already done it?
Let's distinguish right now between medical marijuana and recreational marijuana.
Well, both ways. States pioneered medical marijuana. And now they're pioneering recreational marijuana. So, again, those are examples of states as laboratories of democracy.
Does medical marijuana approval generally precede recreational use?
Yeah, in every state, it's been medical marijuana first, recreational coming later.
And how many states right now are approving medical marijuana, let's say?
It's over a majority. I don't recall the exact number. For recreational marijuana, I think it's around 9 states plus Washington, D.C. have approved it at this point.
It seems to be a groundswell that as I look at, try to look at the future, say 50, 60 years down the road, that it, the approval of marijuana is going to be universal in the U.S. Do you see it that way?
I would suspect that's true. Over time, but the South will be harder to see that happen. So if any region is the laggard region in terms of at least recreational marijuana, it's going to be the South. Another example is physician-assisted suicide, which is now legal in 6 states. The Supreme Court in 1996 specifically said it was not going to nationalize the issue. It was going to leave it up to the democratic process of the states. And so you also have then what's called a diffusion of innovation. One state develops a new idea. Oregon was the first to legalize physician-assisted suicide. And so it gives us a chance to look at that experience and then other states may adopt it. New Jersey was the first state to adopt a Megan's Law. That soon spread to other states. So what's developed in one state may be adopted by other states, and so you have what's called a diffusion of innovation in the federal system.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. John Kincaid, who is professor of government and public service at Lafayette College. We are going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to touch on more of these issues having to do with federalism, United States government, and the states and national government. Stay with us.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
My guest this evening, Dr. John Kincaid, has been Executive Director and Director of Research of the U.S. Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations in Washington, D.C., an assistant and associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas for 15 years before you came to Lafayette, correct?
Correct.
So that's in Denton, Texas?
North Texas is in Denton, Texas, correct.
All right. And did you do approximately the same teaching that you're doing at Lafayette at this point?
About the same, yeah. Same mm-hmm. same types of courses.
Undergraduate students?
Graduate students as well at North Texas. And then much bigger classes of 200 or 300 students. Whereas here at Lafayette, our biggest class is 35 students. So,
that's a huge
Lafayette's
difference.
A small college, yes.
Yes. When it comes to grading papers, you're going to vote for Lafayette.
Absolutely.
I hear you. We were talking about federalism and the sharing of power between the national government and state governments. And the states have always been very jealous of their powers, haven't they? That when the national government comes in, should I be saying national government or federal government?
Either way, we usually refer to it as the federal government.
Correct, the feds.
The feds, right.
Yes, the feared feds. In the past, states' rights were associated with racism and reactionary policies, but the notion of states' rights is enjoying a revival today. Why?
Well, it's enjoying a revival today largely because what some people have called progressive federalism, and that's you see states pursuing very progressive policies in contrast to policies like racial segregation that we had in the past in the South. So policies on immigration, climate change, environmental protection, many other areas, we see a kind of different type of states' rights than we saw in the past. And something going back almost to the progressive era where states were inventing new legislation to meet the needs of an urban industrial society, we're seeing similar developments today. And liberals used to be opposed to states' rights. Now they're more favorable to states' rights. And conservatives who used to be for states' rights are sometimes less supportive of states' rights today.
That's really interesting.
Because they want to nationalize conservative national policy. So we've had a bit of reversal here on states' rights.
Well, ever since we came up with constitution for our government, it's been a constant push and pull between
right.
Washington and the states. And doesn't this just make for a very litigious society in which the states sue the federal government, the federal government sues the states, and we are just making a lot of work for lawyers?
Well, that's an interesting comment, but it's really a recent development. And this is a function of political polarization between the political parties. So when Barack Obama was president, you saw Republican state attorneys general filing a lot of lawsuits against the Obama administration. Now that Trump is the president, you see a lot of Democratic state attorneys general filing lawsuits against Trump. And in fact, I think the number of Democratic lawsuits are going to exceed those that we saw under Obama during the Trump administration. So it depends on whose ox you're goring. And so the state AGs are fighting. Sometimes they're fighting for states' rights against what they feel is an administration that's trampling on them. At other times, they're fighting to have federal policies enforced. So President Trump's backing away, for example, from the Clean Power Plan has led a number of Democratic states to sue the federal government and argue that that was an improper action on the part of the federal government and the Clean Power Plan should be instituted. So they're not always defending states' rights per se, but sometimes looking to implement federal policies that they support.
One of the strengths of our government has to be the separation of powers among the three branches of government. And a question just occurred to me, how does the Supreme Court, because sometimes these suits between the states and the federal government will go to the Supreme Court, but first the Supreme Court has to decide which cases to take.
Right.
How do they decide that?
The court has total discretion on the cases that it decides. It gets close to 10,000 appeals per year and only decides about 78 cases a year.
Oh.
So your chances of getting to the Supreme Court are very tiny. You could win the lottery more easily than getting a case to the Supreme Court. So they try to pick cases based on fundamental issues, constitutional issues that could be settled by a particular case. And so you have the Supreme Court held hearings, oral arguments recently on South Dakota law requiring out-of-state retailers to collect a South Dakota sales tax. And that's a big federalism issue. And so the court saw this as an opportunity to revisit a 1992 decision that it made. And
what was the decision in 92?
In 92, the court ruled states could not collect sales tax on out-of-state retailers. So when you order something online from Amazon, let's say, and it comes from out of state, this decision says states cannot require Amazon to collect the sales tax. Now, what we have now is Amazon and Walmart are voluntarily cooperating with states, but it doesn't apply to the other retailers that are on Amazon, the third-party sellers that you see listed on Amazon. Hardly any of them collect a sales tax, so that's the issue.
I don't understand the ruling of the Supreme Court in 1992 that taxes should not be collected. Is there a really good reason for that?
Well, the reason is that it would interfere with interstate commerce, and states are not normally allowed to levy taxes on businesses outside of their jurisdiction. So Pennsylvania trying to collect a sales tax from a retailer in California is problematic from an interstate commerce point of view. So the Supreme Court said states cannot do that. So if you go to downtown Bethlehem and you purchase a basketball, you need to pay the sales tax because you're here in Bethlehem. But if you order that basketball online and it's shipped to you from Kentucky, let's say, you're not going to pay the sales tax. So the decision prevents Pennsylvania from collecting and other states from doing that. So the current case is revisiting that, and the court is not going to rule probably until after this show is over, but that's an important issue today.
And the internet is becoming such a behemoth for sales across the country and across the world that my hunch is, well, they're losing a lot of tax money, the states are, by not being able to collect these taxes, and that could change.
Right. They're losing in the neighborhood of $12 billion a year in tax revenue. There are 45 states that levy a sales tax, so not being able to collect that on online sales is a problem for them. In addition, the brick-and-mortar stores complain that, again, if you buy the basketball at a shop in Bethlehem, the seller has to charge you the sales tax. But you can get it cheaper online if you don't have to pay the sales tax. So the brick-and-mortar stores feel it's unfair.
So let's go to a political topic. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering partisan gerrymandering cases from Wisconsin, Maryland, and North Carolina, in which it might or might not strike down partisan gerrymandering. First of all, we're going to talk about what in the world is gerrymandering. Why has the court not also intervened in Pennsylvania's partisan gerrymandering? What's the difference?
Gerrymandering comes from Governor Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts in the early 19th century, who arranged election districts in such a way that one of them looked like a salamander, and so it became known as a gerrymander. And so it is the drawing of district lines in a way that benefits one party over another. Both political parties do that. So when either party's in the majority in a state legislature, and particularly with the governor of the same party, it's an opportunity to gerrymander. And so the Supreme Court is considering cases from Wisconsin and Maryland. In the Wisconsin case, it's a Republican gerrymander. In the Maryland case, it's a Democratic gerrymander. And those cases allege that the gerrymandering violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees everyone the equal protection of the laws. So the court had acted on redistricting back in the 1960s when it ruled that every election district must have equal population. And so that still applies today, but that doesn't prevent partisan gerrymandering from occurring. So the Wisconsin and Maryland cases, because they were arguing that the gerrymanders violated the equal protection of the laws clause of the federal constitution, the Supreme Court has jurisdiction. If you look at the Pennsylvania case, that's very different. The League of Women Voters initiated the case here in Pennsylvania, and they very cleverly, I think, argued that the gerrymandering in Pennsylvania violated the Pennsylvania Constitution and not the federal Constitution. And so that's what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ultimately agreed with when it ordered, that struck down the districting that existed and drew a new map for districts in Pennsylvania. So the appeals to the Supreme Court were turned down by the Supreme Court
of the United States.
The United States, because the U.S. Supreme Court is not competent to interpret the Pennsylvania Constitution. And so when a decision is made entirely on the basis of this type of decision based on the state constitution, it's not reviewable by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So that's an answer to a previous question of mine. How does the Supreme Court decide which cases to take?
And so
that's a good case.
That's one example of criteria. So that's why the Pennsylvania case is not heard by the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court will rule on Wisconsin and Maryland. So if the Supreme Court decides that partisan gerrymandering violates the U.S. Constitution, that won't affect Pennsylvania, because we've already made that decision, in effect, in terms of the state constitution. If the Supreme Court rules that partisan gerrymandering does not violate the U.S. Constitution, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling will still stand. All right. So it's really, and I think what we'll see is if the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, rules that gerrymandering does not violate the U.S. Constitution, we will see other states turning their state constitutions like Pennsylvania, and we'll have a lot more litigation going to state Supreme Courts under the state constitutions.
Why would there be any kind of redistricting in the first place?
Well, you have to adjust for population changes. So we have the Constitution mandates a census every 10 years, partly for the purpose of reallocating seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So it should reapportion every 10 years as a result of the census. And that's the controversy over the 2020 census, that the administration has decided to include a question on citizenship in that census form. And many observers believe that this will lead people who are not citizens to duck the census and not want to be counted. And since federal grants are distributed partly on the basis of population and population characteristics, this could have a very, you know, communities that have a large number of non-citizens could lose a lot of federal funding if the count is not accurate. And so that's a kind of federalism angle to that the upcoming census in 2020.
Let's turn to since we're talking about census, I think this is a good time to bring up the idea of sanctuary cities and perhaps sanctuary states. About 300 cities and the state of California have declared themselves sanctuary cities. The whole state of California? As a sanctuary state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only one.
The only one right now.
Right now. So how can cities get away with this?
What those cities are saying is that they will not cooperate with federal officials in apprehending illegal immigrants for deportation. And this really has a long tradition in the American federal system. Because back in 1842, we had a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Prigg versus Pennsylvania over the Fugitive Slave Clause and the Fugitive Slave Act. And the Pennsylvania tried to arrest someone who was apprehending a runaway slave to take the slave back to the South. And the Supreme Court ruled the state could not do that. But the Supreme Court also ruled that the state had no obligation to apprehend runaway slaves, that that's a federal responsibility, and that states could pass what were called personal liberty laws, which said that state and local officials, like local police, for example, do not have to in any way support the apprehension of runaway slaves. That's strictly a responsibility of the federal marshals. So they can't stand in the way of the federal marshals, but they don't have to help them. And this is the basis for the Sanctuary Cities movement, and that's reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in cases in the 1990s, which the court ruled that the federal government cannot commandeer state and local officials to perform federal functions. State and local officials can volunteer, or they can be paid to do that, but they cannot be commanded to enforce federal law. So the sanctuary cities are on firm legal grounds in that respect, going back to the Prigg decision on the Fugitive Slave Act.
Let's make sure that we know what sanctuary cities are. If you're in this country without proper documentation and you live in one of these cities, you cannot be apprehended?
No. What it means is that, well, it applies mostly to people who have been arrested and are in a state or local jail, and then they're released. So what ICE is asking is that if they committed a violent crime, that's a deportable offense. So they want these cities to report those individuals when they're released from prison for ICE to pick up for deportation. So it's really the cities are declining to provide that kind of information to ICE in order for ICE officials to pick up those persons.
Now, ICE is I-C-E, and what does it stand for?
The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Sorry about that.
Yes, no, we frequently hear that in the news about ICE picking up people or not. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. And this is John Pierce, your host. And working the board for us, engineering this evening, is Neil Heaver, our director of operations here at WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. We are ready to take another break. Dr. John Kincaid will be back with me in just a minute. And we are going to talk about such terms as net neutrality, the overhaul of infrastructure. How about arming teachers in schools? Stay with us.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Dr. John Kincaid is professor of government and public service and director of the Minor Center for the Study of State and Local Government at Lafayette College. John, you've been at Lafayette since?
1994. Right. I came up from Washington, D.C.
Okay. Not from North Texas at that point. And what was the what's the order of things from North? It was North Texas to Washington, D.C. to?
Right. I left academic life to be executive director of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, which was an independent federal commission. So I was there for 7.5 years in Washington, D.C., and then decided I would come back to academic life. And so I ended up at Lafayette College.
Why did you decide to come back to academic life?
Sort of the budget battles in Washington were getting really very onerous, and it was a very difficult. I was there from the transition from into the Clinton administration, so I saw the commission through the first year of the Clinton administration, and I could have stayed on, but that whole transition was difficult and budget battles in Congress. And I thought, well, I want to go back to the contemplative life of the academic.
It's a wonderful life if you can be
a great life.
Academic. Oh, yes. So the next topic that I'd like to cover here is something that President Trump at least floated an idea about, and that was to arm teachers in schools because we've had violence, too much violence, in too many schools across the country, as we all know. And so the question is, do you arm those who are in the school in order to fight people who are trying to penetrate, or is that just a very dumb idea? And I've heard it on both sides. This policy decision would be left up to the states. Who decided that it would be left up to the states?
Well, the federal government does not have the constitutional authority to mandate that policy, and only the states could mandate or permit teachers to be armed in the classroom. And so the only way the federal government could sort of mandate it would be to attach it as a condition of federal aid for education. Although I don't know that the Supreme Court would go along with that, because in 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a very major ruling in which it struck down the Gun-Free School Zones Act, which had been enacted by Congress in the early 90s, mandating that every school be designated as a gun-free zone.
Now, that was mandated by the federal government?
By the federal government. And under the guise of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, Congress thought it had the authority to enact that law. And the Supreme Court ruled that it exceeded the commerce authority, that particularly the individual involved in the case was called the Lopez versus the United States. Mr. Lopez was a 12th grade student who brought a gun to school, a handgun, and didn't fire it or anything, but was arrested and tried under the Federal Gun-Free School Zones Act. And so the argument of the government was that bringing a gun to school disrupts the education process. If you disrupt the education process, it has an impact on the economy and a deleterious impact on the economy. And the Supreme Court disagreed and said that that was stretching the Commerce Clause too much and that Congress had exceeded its power in passing that law. So I think the court would probably take the same position if the administration tried to mandate directly or Congress passed a law saying teachers must be armed.
All right. There's nothing in our U.S. Constitution, though, that says something as specific as there shall be no arms in schools. Is that correct?
No, and the Constitution says nothing about education whatsoever, because that was totally left to the states. So the federal government gets involved in education only through grants and aid or through the Bill of Rights. Okay. So under the 14th Amendment, and that's why we had school desegregation mandated by the Supreme Court, because the 14th Amendment sort of authorizes that in the rights area. So in terms of protecting individual rights and ending school segregation, that comes under the 14th Amendment.
What does the 14th Amendment state?
It starts out, it's a post-Civil War amendment, 1868, says no state shall deprive any person of due process of law or the equal protection of the laws. And Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives Congress the authority to enforce that. So it was a very major change in our Constitution, which was a response to the Civil War, and particularly the Dred Scott decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which held that Dred Scott, who was a slave, was not a citizen and not entitled to sue under the Constitution. And so it's the 14th Amendment that also contains the clause that anyone born on U.S. soil is a citizen. And that was to guarantee that all the ex-slaves who, you know, were born on U.S. soil and they would be citizens, and the southern states could not try to deny them citizenship. Mm-hmm. So you have that avenue, but this is not a rights case. So arming teachers would have to come under the Commerce Clause, and I don't think the court would buy that. So the only way the administration or Congress could sort of mandate would be make it a condition of aid and say to the states, if you want federal education aid, if you want the money, you got to arm the teachers. I doubt Congress will do that, but that's the only way they could do it. under our system.
It very frequently comes back to money, doesn't it?
Well, I remember very important.
Remember the case of trying to bring down speed limits across the country.
Right.
And in that case, the federal government said, if you want federal aid for highways, if you're insisting on speed limits of 70 miles per hour or higher, you're not going to get the aid. So we've suddenly got a lot of 55-mile-per-hour speed limits. I think that's crept up now in the meantime.
Well, that law was repealed, so states are free to set the limits at whatever they want now. So
again, it's push-pull from the federal government to the states. And the states generally win those things, don't they?
It really depends. Like the 21-year-old drinking age, that's also a condition of federal highway aid. So Congress initially tried to set the drinking age at 21. The court said, no, you can't do that. And so it's a condition of highway aid. If states don't increase the alcoholic beverage purchase age to 21, they'll lose up to 10% of their money.
Which court said that it was not...
The U.S. Supreme Court.
That 21 could not be the age for legal drinking.
Well, that Congress can't mandate that. Congress doesn't have the authority to set the drinking age. So the way it got around that was to simply say, well, the state set the drinking age at 21, and if you don't, we're not going to give you all your highway money. You're going to lose 10% of your highway money.
Okay.
And so that's how we got 21 across the country. Because I'm of the Vietnam War era, so I remember during the Vietnam War, our claim was if we're old enough to die in Vietnam, we should be old enough to drink.
Which means
and old
age
enough to
18
vote.
At
age
least.
18, and many right. states had 18 as the drinking age.
And do they today?
Nope, no state.
Nope, it's all 21
states,
across the country.
Because none of the states can afford to lose any of that highway money. That's billions of dollars, so they've all increased. So the Supreme Court ruled... South Dakota challenged that, and the Supreme Court ruled that the condition of aid was legitimate under the Constitution because federal aid is voluntary. If a state doesn't want the money, it doesn't have to increase the drinking age. And just that no state can afford to give up the money, that's the problem.
Exactly. Back to money. Some states are trying to defy the Federal Communication Commission's reversal of President Barack Obama's net neutrality rule by requiring communications companies that do business with the state to maintain net neutrality. Can states get away with this? And what in the world is net neutrality?
Well, the net neutrality is kind of a term of art, but it kind of means that all traffic on the internet should move freely without extra charges. So the Obama administration, in order to maintain net neutrality, the Federal Communications Commission decided to treat the internet like the telephone companies of the past, so regulate it. So whereas the Trump administration, which has withdrawn the Obama rule, overturned the Federal Communications Commission, overturned it, created a situation where companies that deliver your internet services could charge more to Netflix and companies like that, which use more bandwidth. And so those companies that deliver those services argue that's more expensive. And so they're using more bandwidth, so they should pay more. So you have different levels of charges on the internet system as a result of that arrangement. So a number of states have reacted to the Federal Communications overturning of the Obama net neutrality rule to try to implement that within the state, that any company that does any business with a state that doesn't observe net neutrality would lose its right to do business with a state. And I doubt that this is going to fly with the U.S. Supreme Court. I think this will be seen as a interference with state interference with interstate commerce. And furthermore, the Federal Communications Commission has said that it's preempting state law in this area. Preemption means that the federal government overrides or displaces state law. So we're going to see court challenges on this. My guess is the states will lose on this issue on the interstate, on interstate commerce grounds.
And that, therefore, the federal government will say that what happens as far as the net neutrality?
So if, you know, Comcast or RCN want to charge more to deliver Netflix services to you or other services that use a lot of bandwidth, they can charge Netflix more for that, which means as the consumer, you'll probably it'd be somewhat similar to the past when we had landlines and you paid more for a long-distance call than you did a local call. That's a rough analogy to the net neutrality thing.
Yeah, you're talking about the old days there.
Right.
Now, we talked a little bit about ICE and the fact that we now have a movement toward sanctuary cities and even California as a complete sanctuary state. Do you see that, if you get out your crystal ball, spreading to other states and other cities? Does it seem to be a groundswell?
I think the movement of sanctuary cities has slowed down. Now, the sanctuary cities phenomenon is partly a function of most big cities are Democratic, and so they would be opposed to President Trump's policies. I think we may see a couple of other Democratic states declare themselves a sanctuary state, but probably not too many. You know, at the present time, and this is before the November midterm elections, 26 of the states have both the state legislature and the governorship controlled by Republicans. So none of them are going to be sanctuary states. We only have 6 states where Democrats control both the legislature and the governorship. One of those is California. So, you know, maybe a couple of those Democratic states will go the way California has gone.
And here in Pennsylvania, we have split between the governor
right.
and the two. But the two houses in Harrisburg are
Republican.
Yeah.
So again, the legislature of Pennsylvania is not going to support a sanctuary city or sanctuary state policy.
Let's go on to another topic that's been in the news since the election of 2016 and maybe before that, and that is the overhaul of infrastructure in the U.S. President Trump has said that the country needs a $1.5 trillion overhaul, but he has pledged only $200 billion. Where will the rest of the money come from?
Yeah, the administration is looking for most of the money coming from state and local governments and the private sector, and move in that direction, the administration's proposal would, for example, allow states to toll interstate highways. That system was built with no tolls originally, so toll-free was kind of a hallmark of the interstate system. The reason a few interstates like 95 are tolled, if you're driving down to Washington, D.C., let's say, they were all grandfathered in. The Pennsylvania Turnpike was grandfathered in because they existed before the interstate system. But so 95 is tolled on parts of the East Coast, but 78 is not, 80 is not. And so allowing states to levy tolls on the highways would be an additional source of revenue. Also, states under the Federal Highway Program are not allowed to commercialize rest areas. And many states don't have enough money to maintain those rest areas, so they're actually closing them down.
Now, so, by commercialize, what do you mean?
Have shops there. Oh. So what the Trump administration is proposing is that states could commercialize them. So you could put shops up at rest areas, and that would be an additional source of revenue. The condition would be that revenue would need to be used on the road that's serviced by the rest area. But so, you know, you pull into a rest area today, it's usually pretty desolate. There's nothing there. There may be some restroom
there. Some vending machines.
Yeah, or maybe a vending machine. But So commercializing them, you could have fast food places there. The kind of thing you see on toll roads, if you go down 95, you get off the Maryland House. You know, that's allowed on that particular road. But if you're on I-80 and you go to the rest area, there's nothing there other than vending machines and a restaurant.
Interesting point. I never noticed that.
Yeah, difference. So it would allow for the commercialization. But so it remains to be seen whether the main problem the federal government is facing is its deficit problem and a limited amount of revenue. But states are in the same situation. For states' governments today, Medicaid, which is health care for the poor, is their single biggest item of expenditure. And it's kind of eating up state budgets, so they have less money available for higher education, less money available for infrastructure. And so there's all these fiscal squeezes coming to play. And so tolls and rest areas and relying on the private sector, maybe private highways, those are other ways of thinking about raising revenue.
Dr. John Kincaid, believe it or not, our time is up for this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I really appreciate your coming in. It's been an honor to chat with you. Dr. Kincaid is Professor of Government and Public Service and Director of the Miners Center for the Study of State and Local Government at Lafayette College.
Well, it was a pleasure being here. I enjoyed meeting you and enjoyed having our discussion.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners, as always, here on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. And my name is John Pierce. Our engineer this evening, Neil Heaver, our operations director. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.